The Flamingo Feather by Kirk Munro. Chapter 1. René de Vaux. On a dreary winter's day early in the year 1564, young René de Vaux, who had just passed his 16th birthday, left the dear old chateau where he had spent his happy and careless boyhood and started for Paris. Less than a month before, both his noble father and his gentle mother had been taken from him by a terrible fever that had swept over the country, and René, their only child, was left without a relative in the world except his uncle, the Chevalier René de Laudonnière, after whom he was named. In those days of tedious travel, it seemed a weary time to the lonely lad before the messenger who had gone to Paris with the letter telling his uncle of his sad position could return. When at length he came again, bringing a kind message that bade him come immediately to Paris and be a son to his equally lonely uncle, René lost no time in obeying. He traveled like a young prince riding a spirited steed, and followed by a party of servants mounted and armed to protect him against robbers and other perils of the day. Behind him rode old François, who had been his father's valet and was now his sole friend and protector. The big tears rolled down the boy's cheeks as he turned for a last look at his home. But, as it was shut from view by the trees of the park surrounding it, he brushed them away resolutely, and turning to his companion, said, "Thou hast seen the last of my tears, François, and with them goes my boyhood, for hereafter I am to be a man, and men know not how to weep." "Well spoken, my young master," replied the old servant, greatly pleased at the brave words of the lad. "Thou art already a man in feeling, and thine uncle Laudonnière will presently make thee one in fact, if the tales that come to us of his valorous deeds be true, and there is naught to disprove them. Tell me of him, François, for though he is my only uncle, I have but little knowledge of him or his deeds, or what nature are they?" "Well, then, he is a mighty navigator, and 'tis but little more than a year since he returned from the New World, whither he sailed in company with His Excellency Admiral Jean Ribault. He brings strange tales of those wonderful lands beyond the sea, and rumor has it that he is shortly to set forth again for them with a noble company who will establish there a sanctuary for our blessed Protestant faith." The boy's interest was thoroughly aroused by this, and he plied the old servant with questions concerning his uncle and the New World. François answered these to the best of his ability, and even drew largely upon his imagination to aid his glowing descriptions of those distant lands of which the men of that day held such vague knowledge. With such talk they beguiled much of the tedious journey that occupied a week ere it was ended, and they entered Paris. Here they were finally set down before a modest dwelling near the king's palace in which Laudonnière was lodged. Upon meeting his nephew, the Chevalier embraced him warmly, and then holding him forth at arm's length to gain a better view of him, exclaimed, "In good sooth, René, thou art a likely lad, and if thy heart be as true and bold as thy face promises, will soon make a man of thee such as even thy noble father would approve." That evening uncle and nephew talked long and earnestly together concerning the latter's future, and ere they slept it was fully decided that, in spite of his youth, he should make one of the expedition that, even as François had reported, Laudonnière was fitting out for the New World. The next 3 months were occupied in busy preparation for the long voyage, not unmixed with vexations, delays, and grievous disappointments, in all of which young René de Vaux bore manfully his share. He became each day more useful to his uncle, who entrusted him with many important commissions, and who, stern old soldier as he was, learned in this time to love the boy as though he had been his own son. At length, all was in readiness. The stores and munitions of war had been placed on board the three ships that formed the little fleet. The last colonist had embarked, and Laudonnière had taken leave of his king and Admiral Jean Ribault, who was to follow him in a few months with a still larger company. On a bright May morning, uncle and nephew reached the little seaport town before which lay their ships, and hastened to embark and take advantage of the favorable wind that promised them a fair start on their long and perilous voyage. As Laudonnière stepped on board his flagship, his broad pennant was flung to the breeze from the mainmast head. The fleur-de-lis of France floated proudly from the mizzen, And amid the booming of cannon and the loud acclamations of the throngs assembled on the quay to bid them good speed, the ships moved slowly down the harbor towards the broad ocean and the new world that lay beyond. For many weeks they sailed ever westward, seeing no ship save their own, and becoming every day more weary of the vast, endless expanse of sea and sky. It is no wonder, then, that when on the morning of the 22nd of June the welcome cry of "Land ho!" rang through the flagship, every soul on board rushed on deck with joyous exclamations to catch once more a glimpse of the blessed land. The cry that had brought them such pleasure had come from the masthead, and it was some time before those on deck could detect the dim blue cloud low-lying in the west that was said to be land. Even then, one man, who was known as Simon the Armorer, was heard to mutter that it might be land, and then again it might not. For his part, he believed the whole world had been drowned in a flood, as in the days of Noah, and that the only land they should ever see would be at the bottom of the ocean. As the day wore on, and before a light breeze, the ships were wharfed towards the blue cloud. It was proved beyond a doubt to be land, for some palm tree sand, tall pines became distinguishable, and above all other sounds came, faint but distinct, the heavy, regular boom of surf. By noon the ships had approached as near to the coast as was deemed prudent, and for the first time since leaving France their anchors were dropped and their sails were furled. They had come to anchor off the mouth of an inlet before which extended a bar upon which the great seas were breaking and roaring so frightfully that no passage for the ships among them seemed to offer itself. Laudonniere thought he recognized the inlet as one leading into a broad river, on the opposite side of which was located an Indian village called Saloy. This place he had visited 2 years before in company with Admiral Ribault, and he determined to reassure himself as to the locality. Therefore, bidding René accompany him, he entered a small boat, and ordering another full of soldiers to follow them, he gave the word to pull straight for the breakers. Just as René thought the boat was to be swallowed by the raging seas, his uncle guided her with great skill into a narrow passage that opened in their very midst. After a few minutes of suspense, during which René dared hardly to breathe, they shot into smooth waters, rounded a point of land, and saw before them the village of which they were in search. On the beach in front of it, a crowd of savage figures, nearly naked, were dancing wildly and brandishing bows and spears. Meanwhile, the village that the boats were now approaching had been thrown into a state of the greatest excitement by the appearance of the ships, which had been discovered while yet so distant that their sails resembled the wings of the white seagull. Upon the first alarm, all the warriors had been collected on the beach, and the women had left their work in the fields of maize and hurried with the children to the security of the forest depths. When, however, the fleet came to anchor and the Indians could distinguish the meaning of their banners, their alarm was changed to joy, for they had learned to love the French, who upon their previous visit had treated them with kindness, as much as they hated the cruel Spaniards, whose ships had also visited that coast. Then the women and children were recalled from the forest, the warriors washed the war paint from their faces, and preparations for feasting were begun. As the small boats approached, the men ran down to the beach to meet them, dancing and waving their weapons in their joy. And when they recognized Laudonniere standing in the stern of the leading boat, they raised a great cry of welcome that caused the forest to ring with its echoes. As the pious leader of the expedition stepped on shore, he took René by the hand, and both, kneeling on the sands, gave thanks to him who guided them thus far in safety in their perilous wanderings. Though the simple-minded Indians could not understand what Laudonniere said or was doing, they were so anxious to show their respect and love for him that all knelt when he did and maintained a deep silence while he prayed. When Laudonniere rose to his feet, the Indians crowded about him with shouts and gestures of welcome, but they readily made way for him when, still holding René's hand, he began to walk toward the lodge of their chief. He was as anxious as his followers to welcome the white men, but his dignity had not permitted him to rush with them down to the beach.